Thank you for tuning into Hey Strangeness. Today, our discussion will center on the topic of ethical creation in the paranormal space. Originally, this episode was going to be a two-part Patreon subscriber exclusive, but after quite a bit of self-reflection and sitting on the interview audio for a couple of months, I decided that the material was just too important to put behind a paywall. Our subscribers will receive an exclusive episode during the month of July, but for now, I wanted to make this available to everyone. Investigation of the paranormal runs across a wide and diverse spectrum. There is the surface-level enthusiast brand, which is the place we all start, which typically manifests through the consumption of books, films, podcasts, and/or other types of media. Then there's another level, where investigation takes on a literal tone. People go out and do physical research, speak to witnesses, visit locations where phenomena have occurred, and turn over a few more stones than would be disturbed by simply watching a documentary. In this way, many of us take ownership over our passions and don't wait for others to do the digging for us. We blaze new trails and pave new ground. From here, it's a short leap to the third category, the content creator. Those who research, gather information and materials, assemble them via their vehicle of choice, and then unleash them on the world. This is a group which is vast and diverse, with levels of commitment ranging from the sometimes updated Instagram account to people who pursue this stuff as a full-time career. It's no secret that the internet and the accessibility it yields have turned a large portion of our population into directors, writers, and podcast producers. TikTok, for example, has turned an entire generation of kids into filmmakers. And I can't wait to see what they do next, honestly. It's honestly pretty cool. But anyone with an idea can enter the creative fold. And today we have a vast, seemingly endless library of content to consume. And this is a good thing. The more minds we have asking questions, the more likely we are to arrive at answers. The more perspectives from which we view a given question, the more theories we're able to deduce. Even if we never arrive at a hard answer, which in the paranormal world we rarely do, we still know more than we would otherwise. As an aside, there's a lot to be said for the therapeutic and cathartic nature of making any kind of art, be it visual, audio, or otherwise. But there is an element to investigation and research, especially as it pertains to the creation of content, which many sometimes overlook. It may be easy for us, in the excitement we experience in chasing the unknown, to lose sight of something essential to not only the stories we research, but also to ourselves. Specifically, the human element, the people who have these experiences, and how having these experiences affects them. For part one of our discussion, we'll look at some examples in which ethical consideration was not necessarily given to the impact made on the witnesses. In part two, I'll be joined by two experts in the field who will share their valuable insight as to what exactly ethical creation in this space means. Hypnotic red eyes, flight exceeding speeds of 90 miles an hour, a sense of dread and doom, odd physical maladies such as conjunctivitis and lingering depression, appearances by the Men in Black, UFO sightings, and so on. We'll begin with one of the most infamous cases in the world of the unsolved, the Mothman. Acolytes of cryptozoology and the general paranormal are well aware of the circumstances surrounding the Mothman sightings. Beginning in 1966, the residents of a small riverside town known as Point Pleasant, West Virginia, began reporting sightings of a winged humanoid creature. The monster seemed to defy the laws of physics, and had bizarre, lasting effects on many of those who witnessed it. On Christmas Eve in 1967, what many consider to be the penultimate conclusion of the, quote, Mothman incident, took place. The Silver Bridge, which connected Point Pleasant to the neighboring town of Gallipolis, collapsed. The death toll was high, made all the more dire by the fact that it took place on a major holiday in a small, close-knit town. The common telling of the story became that the Mothman either arrived in Point Pleasant to warn residents of the impending disaster, or even darker, caused the collapse of the bridge directly. There are a few problems with this narrative. First, the collapse of the bridge did not signify the end of Mothman sightings in the area. Quite the contrary, as they continued in the months to follow and have persisted into the modern day. For an example of this, I recommend looking into the testimony of Ron Lanham of Wild and Weird West Virginia. You may also look into the case of the Lake Michigan Mothman, covered by Tobias and Emily Wayland, and later documented in detail on film by Small Town Monsters. You may also review any one of several volumes detailing encounters with strange humanoid beings, many of them with wings, and begin to get the impression that the Mothman, or something like it, is still with us. Second, and most importantly, there is literally nothing to support the idea that the creature was in any way involved in the collapse of the bridge. There is not video footage of the Mothman weakening support struts or attaching explosives to the rails. There are no wing-shaped prints on the debris to indicate tampering by a supernatural being. There are no bizarre teeth or claw marks on I-bar 330, the bridge component which failed and caused the tragedy in the first place. There is literally nothing, save a few anecdotes that witnesses saw the creature flying or climbing around on the bridge the night before the collapse, and these accounts are considered questionable by many. This becomes a problem very rapidly. 46 people lost their lives on Christmas Eve in 1967. This would be an unspeakable tragedy anywhere, but in a small town, the horror is only amplified. No single resident of Point Pleasant was not impacted by this visceral loss of irreplaceable life. Declaring a link between the bridge collapse and the Mothman phenomena is, in many ways, to gloss over the human toll. Mothman is now a pop culture icon, appearing in video games, cartoons, movies, on apparel designs, and endless other incarnations. There's nothing wrong with that, but when we presumptuously declare that our new mascot caused the deaths of 46 people, we begin to look, for lack of a better term, like ghoulish fiends. Some might blame John Keel for this connection, as his work on the case was highly speculative. The seminal classic The Mothman Prophecies, which was later adapted into a film, takes a few leaps at dissecting the nature of the incident. We might shrug this off by saying that Keel had to sell a book once he wrote it, and a bit of theatrical embellishment is sometimes just the key. And one can hardly be blamed for speculating, asking whether or not these two events might have been connected, examining evidence and reading the testimony of those who were there. But the common retelling today has morphed from a mixed bag of strangeness which took place adjacent to a horrific tragedy to a three-point narrative in which the monster appears, the bridge collapses, and then the monster disappears. This is, quite simply, not what happened. When we enter the modern era and are faced with the surviving relatives of those who died, we might do well to tread more lightly. It's become a rite of passage for some to travel to Point Pleasant and leave a can of beans at the feet of the Mothman statue. A cute idea, except that you're littering in a place where you're also a guest. People live in Point Pleasant, and someone has to pick up those cans of beans. Are there not less intrusive ways for us to express our enthusiasm? From here, we'll move to an example which, admittedly, may not belong in a discussion regarding paranormal phenomena. The fact is, however, that in our community, that of the paranormal, and this community, there is substantial crossover, and very often we find ourselves covering cases that run the line between the truly paranormal and unsolved crime. True crime often bleeds over into the paranormal field, and it's a natural thing. Those interested in the unknown are drawn to mysteries, whether they be unsolved murders or less natural things that go bump in the night. After all, the scariest monsters are the ones that remind us of ourselves. There are TV programs devoted to the investigation of murders via channeling spirits, and it probably won't take the average enthusiast long to come up with a list of examples. The idea that those with a connection to the spirit realm may be able to shed light on unsolved crimes is an enduring one, but in 2023, it is more prevalent in pop culture than ever. I myself find value in true crime programming as a devotee of documentaries, but when mixed with the speculative world of the paranormal, we begin to walk on precariously thin ice. A recent example comes to mind in which a well-known ghost hunter and their team investigated a famously haunted location. During the course of the episode, the investigators made several attempts to contact spiritual entities directly. As the program continued, they then began to attempt contact with deceased former members of their investigative team. The process of loss and grief is different for everyone. Perhaps these people needed this experience as a part of their own healing process. Perhaps they truly believed there was good in what they were doing. But from the outside, viewed through the lens of a consumer of entertainment, the display was disappointing at best. Like the victims of the Silver Bridge collapse, these deceased persons have living relatives. I cannot comment on what they may have to say on the matter, and in truth, have no desire to find out. It is, quite frankly, none of my goddamn business. This case did not occur in a vacuum. During the recent media frenzy surrounding the disappearance of Gabby Petito, certain members of the online paranormal community began to push content claiming they'd contacted Gabby's spirit using their own equipment and had, quote, new information about the case. I'll not name any specific creators as there was more than one, and I simply unfollowed them at the time to get them off my feed. You can probably tell from the tone of my voice just what my opinion on this kind of behavior is. If there is value in this kind of content, I cannot seem to find it. if we are reliant on sensational clickbait, which gives no consideration to the human element, to foster growth of the paranormal community, then that's not something worth growing. There will probably always be a level of sensationalism in any publicly consumable content. There will always be a subset of creators who find this kind of behavior acceptable. But to stoop as low as some have done seems a recipe for disaster. We may enumerate any number of instances where people have reported encounters with the unexplained and had their lives virtually ruined. A recent episode of the rebooted Unsolved Mysteries tells in detail the story of a weather analyst who identified an anomaly which was reported to him by airline pilots and was literally laughed out of town despite the fact that he himself did not make the initial discovery, did not purport that he had seen a UFO, and made no attempt to profit off of the event. He was simply a man living his life who crossed paths with the unknown, and his fellow human beings ostracized him for it. As a consequence, the case went uninvestigated by the research community for years, only recently receiving coverage on a mainstream program. There are countless other examples of similar chains of events, and who can guess what other anomalous occurrences have been buried beneath a landslide of snide remarks and disbelief? These may seem pedantic concerns, and the reality is that there will always be a few bad apples in every bunch. The majority of the members of the paranormal community that I have encountered are ethically minded people creating content based on good research with kind intent. Nevertheless, remaining conscious of the human element to these stories and how our research impacts the experiencers should remain at the forefront of every creator, researcher, writer, and podcaster's mind. The strange conversation you were about to hear was originally recorded in January of 2023, and as previously mentioned, was intended to be a Patreon subscriber exclusive. In addition to that, some of the information discussed here is a bit out of date. Specifically, Jordan Heath and myself are no longer affiliated with Paranormality Magazine or its parent company, Paranormality Media, LLC. That being said, please enjoy this very strange conversation with Jordan Heath of Campfire, Tales of the Strange and Unsettling, and Heather Mosier of Small Town Monsters.
Heather and Jordan, thank you so much for coming to hang out with me today. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Thanks for having us.
Absolutely. We were actually getting into this before I hit record, but there were a few reasons I asked you guys specifically to have this discussion with me. One, I think you're both great and I love talking to you. Two, I realized as I was making notes for this episode that this could come across as very like preachy and condescending and elitist and like you should make content the way I do. And if I know anybody who's good at explaining things in a way that makes sense, it's you guys.
So well, I appreciate that.
Yes, absolutely. You both have ways of wording things where I'm like, oh my God. Yes. But then also knowing you both personally, I know that this is something that you both take very seriously and incorporate into your own work. So Those are the two big reasons, but you know, the major one is that I like you.
So Aaron, what is it that we're talking about today?
We are talking about the ethics of creation in the paranormal space, but not just creation, also of enthusiasm and involvement. And like, how do we engage with this stuff at a continual level while remaining conscious of the human element? The fact that these are real people, real people's lives, real people's experiences. And sometimes our quote research can impact those people's lives. So what does that look like for us? Yeah. I'm curious as to any initial thoughts you guys have or anything that comes to mind.
If you don't mind, well, Heather.
I think the initial thought, of course, is coming from talking with a witness's perspective when it comes to creatures or cryptids or whatnot, before we even get into the paranormal aspect of things. It's the idea of showing the people that you're communicating with and the community that you are in that you are serious, not too serious, not pedantic, right? You're not just so much better or anything like that. You're genuinely interested, like have a genuine interest. And if you don't have a genuine interest for that particular story or cryptid, but you have an interest in the people, that's important. So just continuing to remember that like you said, there is a human element. We are human. It's okay to have conversations that aren't even around strange phenomena at first. Just get to know people, because I mean, who wants to talk to a stranger? I don't. So I think that, I think that's the first thing going forward, is that, you know, be authentic with people and be genuine. If you have some other motive when you're approaching someone, I don't know, rethink it maybe, or just be upfront, be honest about why you're there. For one, that's something that I've always tried to do when I communicate with people, is you talk with them a little bit and then be very forward about what I'm expecting or hoping for from the conversation. And also let them know if they're uncomfortable, that's all right. I get it. And I don't want to push people. That's the other thing. I don't like the pushiness. I can't do that. But yeah, that's my first knee-jerk response.
Yeah. Piggybacking off that, really, I think, and you mentioned the human element, and it, you know, it feels kind of funny to me when people talk about the human element, because the way I view, you know, Fortiana, it's the human element is the element. It's sort of the binding factor between every story of the paranormal that exists, right? And I think that it's been a big problem over the years in paranormal research, especially in the field of cryptozoology, where the witness, the experiencer, and in ufology, really, where the experiencer is kind of left by the wayside. There's a bad habit of like sort of cutting the monster out of the paper and just pulling it out of its context, you know?
That's such a good point. That's such a good point, because I, you know, not to critique anything that anybody else has done or produced, but this is just me talking, but you do see that. We forget that there were witnesses to the Mothman. There were witnesses to the Boggy Creek Monster. So yeah, please continue. I just love that you brought that up.
And yeah, you're right. There are witnesses. And I think the people who really fall in love with this stuff are the people who don't do that, because when you do that, you're losing the most compelling parts of those stories. The most compelling parts of the Mothman phenomenon is not Mothman. It's the effect of Mothman on this town, mm-hmm, on these people, the fact that it, you know, impacted these people for decades, for the rest of most of their lives. You know, that, I mean, that's what makes the story. That's the reason we're still talking about it.
Yeah.
It's not because, you know, two glowing red or floating red orbs. And you know what I mean? It's not the monster.
You make a really good point, because there are other stories even similar to the Mothman saga, like the Batman of Houston or the Owlman, sure, of Monon, where we don't talk about those very much.
Yeah.
And they were pretty non-dramatic compared to the Mothman story. And, you know, I couldn't tell you who saw that thing, but we have books devoted to the names of the Mothman witnesses. So I think it's a really valid point. Yeah.
Another to add to that, since you brought up the influence that it's had on people over decades, the influence it has on the town.
Yes.
I mean, at Point Pleasant, where would Point Pleasant be if not for the Mothman right now? It's a river town. Everybody knows that river towns are dying out, and they have been for quite some time. And this brings tourism and commerce. You know, they embrace this. So even removing the people that were there at the time, it has created this legacy that's continuing and will continue as long as we have these kind of conversations and we continue to have the Mothman Festival and the museum. And that could be with any cryptid story, if any small town wanted to really embrace it. Or even with like the Rougarou Festival that they have, they've used the Rougarou to raise awareness for the environmental plight that's happening down in Louisiana. So, and the same thing with the Jersey Devil, there are conservationists that are using the story of the Jersey Devil to raise awareness for the Pine Barrens and protecting the Pine Barrens and the importance of that. And so these monsters go beyond, like you said, they go beyond the monster on the page. and affect the people that have had experiences, and they affect the communities as well. And that thereby like shape our history. Like we're watching history be made. We're watching folklore evolve as all of this is happening. And yeah, that's, I don't know, that's the fascinating stuff for me.
This is why I asked you guys to be on here. I know I explained that earlier, but this battery of conversation we've had over the last few minutes is just prime example. This will be mentioned in the intro, but I probably should have said this before. Heather, of course, works with Small Town Monsters, also spent a week on the road with me filming the Dogman Triangle and still talks to me for some reason, which is great. Jordan, co-host of Campfire Tales of the Strange and Unsettling, and staff writer at Paranormality Magazine, who deals with me as an editor and also still talks to me. So also part of the
reason. So you must be all right. That's what this means. You must be an okay guy.
I just figured you guys were really patient.
But no, neither of us suffer assholes. So I think that says something for you.
I'll take that. Thank you. So we've talked a little bit about what this looks like in practice. But I'd kind of like to dig into that a little bit more. Do you guys have checklists you go through for yourself when you're dealing with witnesses or experiencers? Do you, you know, Heather, you described it really well, just getting to know these people and talking to them. But I'm curious as to what else that looks like for you. For me, like, for example, for me, anybody I talk to, the very first thing I ask them is, okay, I won't repeat this to anybody, but are you comfortable with me sharing it here or talking about it here or writing about it here? And that's just for me, because God knows I'll forget to ask them later on.
Well, so I guess it depends on what medium I'm using to communicate with people first. Of course, there's an online, with the online stuff, it's slightly easier because I have this, like, I don't want to say script, but it is kind of like a script that I wrote out. And I'm like, that sounds not intimidating, but also straightforward. And I'll use that when I first make contact with people. Just first thing is, hi, my name is Heather Mosier, and I introduce myself, explain why I'm contacting them, and then give them links to things that we've created, because I feel like, and I do this over the phone as well, if they're able to write it down, but I feel like, and this is a line that I've used before because I know this exact feeling, I could be feeding them a line of bullshit and they wouldn't know. They don't know me. So what's been helpful is to give them links to things that we've created, to say, listen, you don't have to take my word for it. I know I'm a stranger, I'm an outsider, but here's what we've created. Look at that and then make your decision. And so that's kind of how I've gone about it for anything with Small Town Monsters. Otherwise, if it's just a personal thing, personal research, I just ask. I just explain why I'm contacting them. You know, hey, I came across your story, or when I did the for volume 3 of the Feminine Macabre, I was looking up headless ghosts and had gotten on ancestry.com to try to find descendants, found the woman who ran the family tree, tracked her phone number down, called her, and left a message and was like, so this is going to sound, this happens a lot, this is going to sound insane. However, my name is Heather Mosier, and I'm doing some research on headless ghosts, and your great-great-grandpa is in the paper as a potential headless ghost, and I'm wanting to know what his story is beyond being a ghost. Like, do you have anything? You seem to be the family genealogist. Do you have pictures? Do you have stories? And people respond well to honesty, I guess, is the best way to put it. And also, there's an element, this again is the human element, of wanting to share your story or your family's story. And so if you're upfront about why you're wanting to preserve these tales, like when we were in Texas and we went to the Plum Creek, one of the Plum Creek Monster original witnesses.
I'm so glad you brought that up. Yes.
So that was James. We went, I found him, called him, explained who I was and what it was. We spoke on the phone multiple times before I even got to Texas. And then he talked to me two or three times while we were in Texas before we showed up. But then, and you were driving me, so you were there when we show up at his house, and he's standoffish.
And I mean, I've spoken to this man multiple times.
His what wife, are y'all doing with those cameras? Yeah.
Yeah. But he.
I thought you knew why we were like,
here. He did. He did know. But it's not the first time that that's happened to me. But, you know, to reiterate that, because once you see people, it is a whole different thing to hear it on the phone and say, hey, we're coming over to film. It's just going to be a couple cameras. But then you show up with eight people and you're showing up in the like the back country down a dirt road. They never see anybody. Of course, it's intimidating. I get it. But mm-hmm. And then I also had to have him sign a release that said we could use his interview. And he did not want to sign it at first. And I had to talk with him for several minutes. And he said, why do you want my story? And I said, okay, well, if you don't tell your story, then all we have are what the newspapers have said. And if you feel that that's not correct, this is the only way right now to get this out there. This helps save your story the way that you experienced it. And he was like, all right, fine. And then he signed it.
I remember like holding my breath in that moment being like, is this guy going to sign this release? Is this going to happen? We've been driving for half a day. Is this going to happen?
Yeah. He signed it. He was like, you don't need my address, do you? Because you got to put it. And I said, well, I don't need your address. I found your house. I know your address. But, you know, I just need your signature, sir.
We know where you
live. So I sent him a Christmas card, by the way, because I thought that might, you know, just like, hey.
Oh, that's nice.
I appreciate your time. Yeah. And his wife warmed up. The thing is that these people were standoffish to begin with, which anybody, I would assume, especially if they've had ridicule in their life from sharing these stories, are standoffish at first. And his wife was protective of him. But then once they were around us and saw that it wasn't a joke, then they both warmed up and were super sweet.
Yeah. To where like we had to figure out a way to like we got to figure out or wrap this up and leave because this conversation is so pleasant and continuing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So
that's awesome. I think the most important step there was like driving home the fact with the witness, with the experiencer that like you're valuable, your story means something. You know, I think this whole industry is so, I mean, you hear it every time a story is told, every time, no matter what arena within the subject matter, right? No matter what arena, you hear it in every story that people are reticent about coming forward because of fear of ridicule, right? It just goes hand in hand with all of this. So I think when I have someone on the show that I think that's the main thing for me is letting them know that like I take it seriously, that is, it's not a joke. Like we're not going to be making fun of you. We're not going to like put your story. The only person that decides the tone of your story is you. And we're going to stay true to that. Right. Because some people, you know, they do frame it kind of lightheartedly, even if that's a defense mechanism or whatever. And that's fine. Right. It's because the story belongs to them ultimately. And our show only serves as a megaphone for them to tell their story. And that's huge. I spend a lot of time before I have some, especially when it is just when it is an experiencer rather than, you know, another podcaster or an author, or when I have an experiencer on, I spend a lot of time talking to them before, like in the weeks leading up, I spend a lot of time, you know, chatting back and forth with them, building a relationship. And even once we do it, say we set a time for like 9 p.m. to get together, I won't end up pushing record until 10 or 10:30. I think it's important to take that time to build rapport with them and make them comfortable. Not only does that make the experience better for them, it makes the experience better ultimately for the listener, because it's a much warmer conversation. You're much more likely to actually get to the core of the story with them. And it leads to a more honest experience for everyone, I think.
I agree. Yeah. And I think that's something you guys excel at.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks. Both of you guys. Like, again, this is why I wanted to have this conversation with you, because I've witnessed both of you in practice doing this. And I'm like, yes, that's how it should be done. and again, I think there are a lot of examples of times when this wasn't necessarily taken into account. And I'm sure we could name any number of them. I don't know if there are any that particularly stick out to you guys.
I mean, for me, when I think of like unethical practices in the paranormal, I have to immediately mention the wave of hypnotic regression stuff that went on in ufology for a long time. I think there was a lot of, you could call it fuckery going on there. You know, people talk a lot about like Bud Hopkins and stuff like that, that just the concept of like putting the experiencer in this malleable state and then sort of leading questions and guiding them to, and then they kind of just cherry pick things to suit their own, whatever agenda they're selling. You know, ultimately, I think a lot of that went on. You talk about like the Betty Andreasen story. There's a lot there. But yeah, that's what sticks out to me when it comes to unethical stuff. A lot of early cryptozoologists too, like going to other cultures, and they get just a vague idea of what this legend is. And they just hear like, oh, 6 to 8 feet tall. And they're just like, Tim, put another one in the Bigfoot column. And like, and they walk away. Yeah, there's been a lot of that too.
So this is something that entering the field and being involved with like small town monsters, that's the extent of my involvement and experience with other than like personally contacting witnesses. I don't know what it normally is like. I only have the STM experience. So I don't know what documentary film companies are normally like. I don't know what it's like to work for the Discovery Channel or anything like that, or how they approach witnesses. I'm kind of learning this all as I go. All of that to say that I have had witnesses, and this happened when we were doing American Werewolves. That was the first experience I had with it. A witness that said she wanted to talk to us, but she wanted to read over the release form, which is fine. You know, obviously you should read over anything that you sign, because she wanted to ensure that the story remained hers. And yeah. I was like, wait, what? What are you talking about? And she explained, because she had been on other shows in the past, that she had at one point signed a form that was a release form like that. But as she signed it, she signed her story over to the network, to the show, that it was no longer her story. She could not repeat it again. So she couldn't go on like another documentary later and tell her experience. She couldn't go on a podcast, tell her experience. It was theirs now. And, then other things started to make sense, because then, I mean, as I'm trying to find witnesses and people, I watch other shows, documentaries to find people. And I've noticed even on shows that you may see on national television, stories change. And now I'm wondering how much of that is because they signed with whatever channel that said, I can't repeat the story just like this. So then when they get, asked by another documentary team, they have to change their story slightly. And then it looks inconsistent for anybody who's paying attention, but it's really that they signed a legal document that said it's not their experience anymore. And that is unethical to me. Wow. I get sort of from like, I guess from a business perspective, like you don't want competition, but we're in what business right now? Okay. Like, let's calm down about staking claim on stuff. It's not your story. I don't understand that. That just blew my mind. It made me so, so frustrated. And another thing that I've heard, like just as I've contacted different people, that because some of these witnesses have far more experience as far as sitting in front of a camera than I do, because they've been on multiple shows. There are people that have been picked to be on shows because of the way that they look, that they fit a certain demographic, and then they're told what to say to a certain extent. Or in some times when they have experiences, this was, I narrated an audiobook once upon a time, and the author of the audiobook was recounting a story where she was sent out, I forget what the show was called, but they flew her out to like California from Boston area and had her recount her story. They sat her there, listened to all of it. And then they said, okay, we want you to say a few key phrases, and just wanted her to repeat things like, I was so scared, you know, I was terrified, and I wanted to quit everything or whatever. And she fought with them on a few of them, but that's where they cut those little one-liners in that can completely change the story itself.
Yep.
And I don't like that at all. I mean, I'm not the one that's editing it, but I don't like that. I don't like the ownership, claiming ownership of someone else's experience and story. That's bullshit. And then the one-liners, I can see if you need it for a trailer or something, some like quick one-liner for a trailer maybe, but to throw in a line that is completely counter to what they said is another thing. And that was the sticking point in that particular book. There was a phrase that they wanted her to say, and she said, I'm not saying that, because she was running a business and she didn't want them to somehow use that phrase and it reflect poorly on her business. So at least she had the foresight to tell them no when it came to that. But I mean, some people get so swept up in all of this as well. Like I do have a story. People want to hear it and they're excited to be behind the camera.
Yeah.
Or in front of the camera, I guess I should say. And they would be willing to agree to just about anything just because they want their story out there. And then that it comes on us, the people recording the story, to, you know, be decent humans about it. Because they're trusting you to not screw them over.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think what you're talking about is the line between documentary and reality TV.
Mm. Yeah.
Right. And that's a huge that's a huge thing. With signing away your story, also, I talked to a guy who had a Bigfoot encounter, and he went on one of those shows. And not only did he. You know, because he was like you were talking about, he got swept up in it, and he just like they were handing him papers and he was signing. And then he was, you know, like mid interview, he told me he's sitting in front of the camera. They're like touching up some makeup on his forehead or something. And they just hand him a paper, sign this. And he signs it and walk away with it. And like one person after another. Anyway, turns out not only did he sign away the right to tell the story again himself, he also signed away all rights for optioning the story in the future. So it gave the production company the right to option his story for like movies, for TV, for everything.
Wow.
So like
how can you own somebody's memories? Like,
you have them sign a paper. That's how you do it.
That's it. That's all it takes.
Well, I've got some ideas about some stuff I'm going to own. So no, like, that's so frustrating. And like those, neither of the things you guys mentioned, or none of the things you guys mentioned rather, had made their way into my notes. So I'm really glad you brought all of that stuff up. You know, like these are people.
Yeah.
These are people like that are living their lives and are, that's just, oh, I'm so upset by this, but also, also very enlightened. That was as interesting as it was frustrating.
Yeah.
So I think we can agree that it is possible to do this stuff ethically. We talked about several examples as to, you know, what that looks like in practice. We've talked about why people are reticent to share these stories, why they're hesitant to divulge their experiences on camera, and some of the ways in which that can go wrong. This may be too broad reaching of a question for a conversation just between three friends, but can we do this on a massive scale? Like, we've talked about so many examples of ways in which this has not been done. The human element has not been considered. And a lot of it seems to come from the mainstream. So I'm not asking this question very well, but what do we do next?
I think I mean, if we talk particularly with cryptozoology stuff, the star appears to be the monster, right? Mm-hmm. Which I get it. I fucking love monsters.
Sure.
Right. Of course I do. I always have. And I own my fair share of Mothman shirts and Bigfoot shirts and, you know, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But I think that focus, that, because it's easy to put Nessie on a keychain, you know what I mean? I think that if we could, as an industry, find a way to shift the focus to the witness, to the experiencer, to the human element, as you put it earlier, I think that could go a long way. Hmm. I think also sensationalizing things just for the clicks is a big problem. I think that's something that could be done away with pretty easily. Actually, I think it sounds like a huge shift, but just stop clicking on things that you know are bullshit. Just quit it, everyone. Stop clicking on things that you know are bullshit.
Just don't.
If everybody just stops, then it's not going to be advantageous to make bullshit clickbait anymore. You know what I mean?
It's fair.
I don't know. That's a big thing, but
no, you're right though. Like, you know, if you see a headline that says Loch Ness Monster captured in New York, that's probably not what actually happened.
Yeah, just quit it. Bigfoot eats 13 people in, you know, Hawaii. Stop. Just don't click it. Yeah.
Well, so that would require a shift in the consumer as well. Yes. Like, that's the main point, is the consumer would have to make the shift, because any business, if they're wanting to make it a business, is going to follow what the consumers want to consume. Mm. This brings it back to the human element as well. As humans, we like to watch the train wreck, right? We may not want to be a part of it, but this is like reality TV.
Oh yeah.
It's fun to watch because it shuts you off from your own stresses of the day. And I feel like for us to move away on a larger scale, that is like a systemic change that we have to occur, that has to occur in the society, where we're not going to be drawn to watching all of this chaos because our lives are a mess. And I don't think that that's something that, I mean, maybe certain individuals can make that conscious choice, but on a larger scale, I just don't know if, maybe I'm reaching too far. I just don't know if our society can do that yet, because I don't know if we're set up to be able to find escapism in another way. Mm. It's really easy to turn your TV on and watch the chaos and shut your mind off for a minute, because we have so much crap going on, where maybe if society wasn't so messed up right now, that wouldn't be what we're drawn to. Maybe we would be more apt to go on adventures and go out hiking and go on vacations if we had more, you know, more leave, like more vacation time or something. Mm-hmm. But we don't have that. That's just the society that we're in. And so we're drawn to the chaos to a certain extent.
Yeah. We take that catharsis where we can get it when we can. And
exactly.
We don't worry so much about the human cost. Yeah.
When it comes to like that kind of thing. So I think, like, I mean, it may not be fair to even throw these guys out there, but because I've only watched a couple shows, but like Mountain Monsters is fine. Like, it's a great show. It's a show that, I don't know, it's calming if you want to watch it, but I don't think that there's any way to think that everything they're doing is serious. I think it's kind of out there and obvious that this is a show, and yeah, they're going to throw in elements of folklore, story or whatever, but this is entertainment. If we're forthright about that, maybe we can head off some of the problems as well. But I can't tell you the number of times that, even with like Small Town Monsters is a documentary film company, we've been at events and people have come up to us and they're like, when are you going to make a real movie? Documentaries aren't seen as real movies because it's not fake. Yeah. I guess it's not like, I mean, even when we have like The Bell Witch and Jersey Devil, where we have like little vignettes with actors, people love that stuff. But it's still not a real movie to them, because we have people, like talking heads, explaining the history and the folklore behind it.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I don't know how we shift everything on a major scale, but the clickbait stuff, that's also the businesses, like beyond our small businesses, right? This is a ladder.
Wow. Yeah.
Because if YouTube and Instagram and all of the social media platforms didn't monetize things and then give that emphasis, like when you put stuff on YouTube, and I'm not the person at the company who goes over this stuff, but I do know that there are reports that they send and they will say, you know, this video performed so well. Now look at the thumbnail. It's all about the thumbnail. Yeah. How does the thumbnail look? The thumbnail and the caption, or like Instagram, the hashtags, or the music track that's behind it. They will give you the analytics of which works and which doesn't and see how it performs. And then that encourages you to alter your content to get the most number of clicks, or, you know, whatever, because all that goes into ad revenue and everything else. Or even with the Instagram, like Instagram reels, people can monetize the Instagram reels just having people watch them. But how do you get people to watch them? Well, you have to have the right hashtags. You got to have the right music.
You follow the trends. Yeah.
You got to follow the trends, right? Because the algorithm picks it up. I put in a reel the other day that had like Deftones, Change was the song. Mm-hmm. That, if I look at my analytics on all of that, it did less, like it performed less as far as views than the other ones that I put out recently, because those have the trending music that's happening right now. I guess it's difficult if you want to make a living in this field to a certain extent to hold on to all of the pieces that we know are right, I guess, if that makes sense, and not fall into some of the clickbaity things, or, you know, those one-liners for the trailers, because if you're wanting to make it your livelihood, you kind of have to a certain extent, feed into it, at least to get people there. Mm-hmm. Once they're there and they can see what you've created, then maybe you've got a chance, I guess, at kind of converting them over.
Yeah.
But still, I mean, we constantly get people about, you didn't even find Bigfoot on this one. No, really?
Yeah, neither has anybody else ever. What?
Right. Yeah. Right, exactly.
At least you didn't have the, you know, the bluster to name your thing Finding Bigfoot.
I never found him.
Yeah.
You can't call something Finding Bigfoot for X consecutive seasons and not find Bigfoot.
Right.
But that's
if right. If they were honest, they would call it Looking for Bigfoot. It's not that hard.
Which I would be here for.
Yeah.
I would sign up for Looking for Bigfoot.
Yeah.
And that's another thing that we think about. Like, it's so Finding Bigfoot, when we're frustrated that it's called Finding Bigfoot, but who are we frustrated with? Do we even know who we're frustrated with? Because who made that call?
Yeah.
I highly doubt that it was Cliff and Renee and Matt. You know, like, I don't know. Maybe they came up with the idea, but still, they weren't the ones that probably made that final decision. That's someone else on the creative team or producers, or
they don't do the marketing. They don't do the analytics. Yeah. They don't. Yeah.
Right. There's so many people involved.
They just
so
try many to find
places for things to get twisted.
I mean, it's art by committee, right? It's you're never going to have an ideal situation in that. Yeah,
exactly. Like, the only way that works is if you are the one person, which is impossible. If you're the one person creating all of this by yourself, then you can have complete control and you can mold it and shape it however you want. But once you start bringing other people in, you're welcoming their thoughts, their interjections. And as you get larger, then you have to outsource some of these jobs. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's no way that a larger network show isn't giving jobs to 20-year-olds in Hollywood to edit the show that don't care or know anything about the topic. It's just their job. Here you go, $8 an hour, edit this. And then the next time they're editing a completely unrelated topic, that's just their job.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we keep the integrity, I guess, to a certain extent, keep the integrity of a show whenever we're letting it out there? But that's the only way to succeed as well. For the larger stuff, there's no way that you could have all of that work
and everything fall into place without more people and expanding things. It's just, it's a really weird cycle. I guess.
Catch 22.
Yeah. I mean, that opens up like huge ethical questions about humanity in general, right? Mm-hmm. Like massive, like this constant need for progress, right? Like,
right.
At no point are we ever going to say like, this iPhone is good enough. We're done.
Well, no, because there's a new one next year.
Exactly.
Like, better camera.
Yeah. I'm probably going to buy it. I'll be honest. Yeah.
We don't ever stop. So maybe it's a matter of knowing when enough is enough, right? Like if I could make enough, and I say this, of course, but who really knows? If I could make enough money through what I do in this field to support me and my family and live comfortably, I think I would at that point balk at the idea of sacrificing things ethically to go a step higher and a step higher, right? Just for more resources, for more money, right? I think I would stop. I like to think I would stop.
Right.
I'll say that. But I think when you're in that, when you're standing on that, you know, that rung of the ladder, maybe it is really hard to resist grabbing the next rung if you can.
Yeah. As someone, like, I'm not at that level, so I don't know what it would be like to be there. But from just observing humans, what happens, unless you are completely disciplined from the beginning when it comes to your lifestyle and spending habits, what people tend to do when they get more money is they spend more money. They get used to more luxury, right? So I would imagine that whenever you make more money and you spend more money, you get used to a lifestyle, then you have to make more money continually to maintain that lifestyle, which would make it harder if that's your sole source of income to turn down those things. Because what are you going to do? Go back to where you were?
Right.
Who wants to do that? You know, like, I'm not saying that it's right. I just feel like that's also human. No one wants to go back to being dirt poor if they can get out of it.
Yeah.
People don't, you know, claw their way out of debt just to fall right back into it because they're concerned about ethics.
Yeah.
Because at that point, then it's taking care of my family and making sure that they're okay.
Yep.
Then you throw the community out the window.
Yeah.
Right. You throw the community out the window because I got to look out for me and mine.
Yep.
Not you and yours. You deal with that. That's on you.
Yeah.
I got to worry about my people. It is very sticky.
Yeah. And it gets into some really big questions that I'm not qualified to answer. But
because at that point, you're on the train track, right? And do you save the person you know, or do you save the 50 people that are strangers? Right.
Right.
It's a classic ethical dilemma. As an example of what you're talking about, that's completely off the beaten path. Growing up in the 90s in the Midwest, the end all be all was to get a job at working for the UAW, whether it be a GM plant or a Ford plant or whatever it is, right? Working for that union was like, oh, if you could get that union job, you'd be set for life, right?
Mm-hmm.
I actually had a chance to work at a GM plant for a while when I was young, and you would be shocked at how many people that work in those plants work until they die. They don't, instead of retiring at 30, they end up working until they're 80. I mean, I remember waiting on people to fix machines that could barely stand up on the platform. They're just so old, right? And I think that's a great example of people. They just keep going, right? If you make $25 an hour, you spend this much money. If you make $35 an hour, you spend this much money, and everyone is still left, seems to be left with the same amount over.
Mm-hmm.
They're just spending more.
Yeah. Well, and when you get to some of the older workers, if it's not a matter of that they actually need to work, but maybe they want to work for whatever reason, it may be, maybe they don't want to stop because that's it. Once you're done, you're done.
Yeah.
But it could also be
with some people that they want to continue to accumulate as much as they can for their descendants, their children, yeah. their grandchildren, because they don't want them to have to do the same work that they're breaking their back doing every day.
Yeah.
And then again, that goes to, I'm looking out for mine, not yours.
Yep.
Like I have to make sure that my family is taken care of. And in order to get past that, again, that would have to be a massive systemic change
yeah.
in our
yeah.
society yeah. where we start taking care of each other better. Yeah. And people don't have to feel so isolated and individualized.
Yeah.
And that's beyond the cryptid community to do so.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Again, I also, we're into human nature and which is what we've been talking about this entire time, yeah. you know, it's the yeah. human element, but then we're getting into what motivates us as human entities. And that's,
yeah.
Dang, I don't know, man. I ain't smart
I also at GM worked with a shocking number of men in their 70s who are still paying alimony and child support on like 17 failed marriages.
Oh, wow.
Like some ridiculous note. So they're like, I can't retire because I'm still paying alimony to 9 ex-wives.
Oh, and no.
Yeah, there's so much of that. I was like 19. And I was like, who are these men? Yeah.
That's a real like experience framer. Like, okay, yes. here's some things that I might want to be conscious of.
Yeah, exactly. Lots of red flags to avoid.
Yeah. Jordan, Heather, Jordan, this conversation went a million times better than I ever could have imagined in my mind. So thank you so much. Thank you.
And you had such high expectations to begin with.
I did. I really did. No, but like really legit. Thank you so much. I am going to go ahead and wrap us up because we're coming up on the hour and I got to go feed a baby.
Sure.
But you are both amazing. And I will look forward to speaking with you both again soon.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. This was awesome.
Of course.
Thank you.
Of course. You guys have a great night. Thank you so much.
Thank you once again for tuning into Hey Strangeness. If you enjoyed this episode format, you might consider signing up for our Patreon and joining the Strange Folk. At the $5 tier, you get access to a 2-part bonus episode, a lot like this one, every month, along with a bunch of other cool content that I won't spend a bunch of time talking about right now. A very special thank you to Jordan and Heather for joining me for this discussion and also waiting a very, very long time before I finally released the audio. And that's it. That's it. Have a great day. Thank you for listening. This was a long one. Thank you for listening. Stay strange.